Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Adele Stan, director of Right Wing Watch, who assesses rising concern about the threat posed by armed white supremacist and militia Trump allies to foment intimidation and incite violence at election polls. Marjorie Cohn, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, who examines President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett's judicial record, and what Senate Democrats can do to slow down or stop the confirmation process. And Tabitha St. Bernard Jacobs, Deputy Executive Director of Program with Women's March, who talks about the group's recent actions and why they're marching again on October 17th to defeat Donald Trump in the November election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In late August, Chinese authorities arrested 12 Hong Kong democracy activists who were fleeing the city in a speedboat in the South China Sea. Those arrested have been denied bail, held without charge in a Chinese detention center, and barred from meeting their lawyers. Beijing claims those arrested were separatists, a crime which can carry the death sentence in egregious cases. Among the most prominent of those detained is Andy Lee, who was arrested on August 10th during a police roundup of pro-democracy activists and charged with colluding with foreign elements. Lee, who organized poll monitors in recent Hong Kong elections, was released on bail. The dozen arrestees face charges of rioting, arson, and assaulting a police officer. Anxiety about Beijing's tightening grip over Hong Kong has only intensified since the Communist Party imposed a sweeping national security law on the territory in June to punish vaguely defined political crimes such as subversion. Over the last year, 200 Hong Kong activists have fled to Taiwan to avoid arrest or prosecution. An investigation by Britain's Channel 4 uncovered a scheme by the 2016 Trump campaign to actively discourage 3.5 million African Americans from voting in key battleground states. They were targeted with negative Hillary Clinton ads on Facebook. The secret effort concentrated on 16 swing states, several narrowly won by Trump after the black Democratic vote collapsed. The investigation leaked a copy of the Trump campaign election database, which held records of 198 million Americans and contained details about their domestic and economic status acquired from market research firms. Voters were allegedly segmented into 8 categories. One was marked deterrence, and those placed in the special category who were voters most likely to vote for Clinton or not at all were disproportionately black. The deterrence campaign was crafted with the aid of the now-discredited firm Cambridge Analytica, which had obtained tens of millions of Facebook profiles for the 2016 Trump campaign. This and many other factors accounted for Clinton's defeat, including widespread Republican state legislation designed to suppress the vote in communities of color deemed likely to support Democratic Party candidates. The U.S. labor movement, on the defensive and losing membership since the days of Ronald Reagan, is looking for a rebound with Joe Biden's campaign after losing union voters to Donald Trump in key battleground states 4 years ago. Biden, with his ties to Obama and blue-collar appeal, is working to recapture union households on November 3rd. Along with Trump's anti-union policies, labor is battling a hostile U.S. Supreme Court whose conservative majority ruled against public sector unions mandating collective bargaining fees in the 2018 Janus ruling. Earlier this year, labor crafted a far-reaching agenda during an assembly for a clean slate for worker power. It calls for industry-wide bargaining, a broader right to strike, streamlined union elections, more rights for independent contractors, and an end to anti-union right-to-work laws. Biden's platform says he'll establish a cabinet-level working group of union representatives. Sarah Nelson, the dynamic progressive head of the Association of Flight Attendants, cautions not to put too much faith in Biden's promises. She says, "I don't really look to the Democrats for leadership. As long as we outsource our power to politicians, we are never, ever going to get what working people need." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Donald Trump's refusal to condemn white supremacists during the September 29th presidential debate and blaming Antifa and the left for violence was interpreted by racist militia and vigilante groups as a warm embrace. When Trump asked Fox News moderator Chris Wallace, "Who would you like me to condemn?" Democratic candidate Joe Biden could be heard saying, "Proud Boys." Trump responded by saying, "Proud Boys, stand back and stand by." Members of the group quickly adopted Trump's phrase as their new slogan and considered the president's remarks as a green light to incite further violence. When Proud Boys members gather, they often carry firearms, bats, and wear protective gear, and some have been convicted for assaulting progressive and anti-racist activists. In recent months, Mr. Trump and his supporters have called for military veterans and off-duty police to come out on Election Day to monitor polling stations in inner-city precincts for what the president describes as an election at risk for widespread fraud. Voting rights groups fear that this effort is actually intended to intimidate Democratic voters, targeting communities of color, which could provoke violence. Your reporter spoke with Adele Stan, director of People for the American Way's Right Wing Watch Project. Here she discusses rising concern that Trump's call for the support of armed white supremacist groups during the election, combined with his refusal to agree to a peaceful transfer of power if he should lose, could result in an attempt to stop the vote counts in some battleground states and steal the election.
Even if they are small in number, you know, their aim is to disrupt. And it doesn't take a lot of people to disrupt through violent means. As we've seen, unfortunately, in the U.S., with, you know, all of these mass shootings, you know, many of them pinned to right-wing hatred. But the other thing that happened in that debate was that he also called for his people, quote unquote, to show up at the polls, to be poll watchers, but not necessarily in the official way, right? I mean, he didn't say, "Oh, make sure you get registered to be an official poll watcher." And no, he said, "Go to Philadelphia because bad things happen there." And why would he say that? Because he wants to intimidate Philadelphia voters, because Trump does not have a path in the Electoral College that his campaign can see without winning Pennsylvania. And Philadelphia, of course, you know, like most urban centers, is the Democratic stronghold. So you have this blending of this sort of, "Hey, Proud Boys, stand by," and then this call, "Hey, my people, you got to go watch these polls in Philadelphia because bad things happen there." And then all of the misinformation, disinformation on vote by mail. And you have just a setting for a post-election conflagration. And it seems like, you know, he feels that that could work for him.
Adele, although Donald Trump tried to walk back his refusal to condemn the white supremacists in the debate a few days after that, few Republican legislators came forward to even mildly criticize Trump. Just a few. What does that say about the Republican Party these days?
Well, it says that the Republican Party is about power, whatever it takes. And Donald Trump, you know, they think he's got the recipe for it. So they're going to stick with him. And it means that they really don't care a lot about the fate of our nation. I mean, this is the descent into authoritarianism. We have already seen the kind of rape and pillage of the economy that Trump has done long before we had the pandemic. And they're all fine with it. A few of them, like before he passed, David Koch kind of turned up his nose at Trump, but they reaped the benefits of Trump's election. So there's a lot of Koch money going into shoring up Republican candidates who will support Trump.
Well, we only have time for this last and difficult question for, I think, any of us to answer, Adele, but I'll challenge you with it. How can our listeners prepare for a contested election and a possible coup attempt, violence, and the like, which may follow chaos on Election Day? What would you suggest our listeners do right now to prepare themselves?
You know, I don't have a magic wand, and I just don't know what there is to do, Scott, other than to be prepared to go into the streets and to demand what is yours, but try to avoid confrontation with armed people. And it's not easy. It won't be easy, but it means organizing. Organize within any group that you are a part of, whether it's a church group or a yoga studio or whatever it is, you know, whatever connection you have to other people. Try to make a pact within your group that says, hey, if things get ugly like this, we are going to meet here and we're going to march here and we're going to join up with other people here and there. And that's going to be the only thing that I can imagine that can be done. And it will be, you will have to assess the risk for yourself, you know, and your family in doing so. But if you can take that risk, it's really important that you do.
That was Adele Stan, director of People for the American Way's Right Wing Watch Project. Learn more about the extremist groups aligned with Donald Trump and the threat they pose to the November 3rd election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who for 27 years was a tireless defender of gender, LGBTQ, and civil rights, the battle is now joined over President Trump's nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, to fill RGB's seat on the High Court. There's widespread anger at Republican hypocrisy for denying President Obama a hearing on his Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland in 2016 because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell at the time said it was an election year, but now moving quickly to confirm Coney Barrett, even as millions of Americans have already voted. Additionally, there's great concern about the extremist views Judge Barrett will bring to the court if confirmed on issues such as reproductive civil and labor rights, environmental and corporate regulation, and access to health care. Your reporter spoke with Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and author. Here she examines Judge Amy Coney Barrett's judicial record, what, if anything, Senate Democrats can do to slow down or stop the confirmation process, and options open to rebalance the court if Barrett is confirmed, which would cement in place a 6-3 conservative majority for decades to come.
With Amy Coney Barrett, we would get a very, very radical right-winger for perhaps four decades if she lives into her 80s, unless, and I know this is something we're going to talk about, unless the Congress decides to pass term limits and so that there isn't this political game that goes on. If Biden were to win the election, and he needs to win overwhelmingly, I think, to minimize the chances of it being stolen by Trump, and the Democrats take back the Senate, then I think there is a chance that they would expand the number of people on the Supreme Court to try to dilute that very lopsided radical right-wing ideology. And it's been done before. There is nothing in the Constitution that says that there have to be 9 justices on the Supreme Court. There have been fewer, there have been more. If Biden wins and takes office, and if the Democrats take back the Senate, they will increase the number of justices on the Supreme Court and set term limits. I think the House of Representatives introduced legislation or passed legislation to decrease the terms. They're now life terms and make them 18-year terms and stagger them.
Please tell us a bit about Roe versus Wade and also Amy Coney Barrett's Trump's nominee on her attitude towards contraception and women's access to contraception under the Affordable Care Act.
Amy Coney Barrett called Roe v. Wade a judicial fiat. And she wrote, the framework of Roe essentially permitted abortion on demand, and Roe recognizes no state interest in the life of a fetus. When she was on the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, she wanted to rehear a case that could limit the right to a pre-viability abortion. She wanted to overturn Supreme Court precedent that allowed states to regulate protesters who block abortion access. She voted to require that parents of girls under 18 be notified before abortions are performed. And to answer your question about contraception, she opposed access to contraception under the Affordable Care Act as an assault on religious liberty. She is a devout Catholic, and many of the, in fact, she would be the sixth Catholic on the Supreme Court. Sotomayor is also a Catholic, by the way, and she's quite liberal. But Barrett is a member of a cult called People of Praise, and she once stated that a legal career is a means to an end, and that end is building the kingdom of God. That's really her main motivating force here. People of Praise is a cult that demands strict adherence. It is the men that make the decisions. The women go along. Each male member of the cult is assigned what's called a head, a man to make decisions for him, and each woman is assigned a handmaid. Now, after The Handmaid's Tale came out, they changed the name because it didn't sound very good. And during Barrett's contentious confirmation hearing for the Court of Appeals in 2017, Dianne Feinstein, a Democratic member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, confronted her and said, "The dogma lives loudly within you." And in other words, you are going to be motivated by your religious beliefs and may not follow the law. Her religious beliefs and the way she feels about them, that, you know, the reason that you have a legal career is to serve the kingdom of God, combined with her disdain for stare decisis, for respect for Supreme Court precedent, make for a lethal combination if she joins the Supreme Court.
In your view, do the Senate Democrats have the tools they need to slow down or stop the confirmation process before the November 3rd election? Certainly a monkey wrench has been thrown in to the mix there for Mitch McConnell and the Republican majority in the Senate, and that's the fact that just in recent days we've learned that three Republican senators have contracted the coronavirus.
It looked like it was a train that could not be derailed, but I think if the Democrats are willing to play hardball, and it's not a foregone conclusion that they will, they could slow it down or even stop it. The GOP has a 52-48 majority in the Senate, and losing these three senators and possibly another one if Mark Kelly is successful in Arizona in defeating Martha McSally. He would actually take over in November. So the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is where this nomination will start and where the questioning would take place, which has a Republican majority, needs a quorum, and the Democrats could refuse to show up. And that would be a problem. And even if they did show up, there may not be a quorum because Mike Lee and Tom Tillis, who are members of the Judiciary Committee, two Republicans, have the coronavirus. So what Mitch McConnell wants to do is to recess for 2 weeks to give them time to heal. Mm-hmm. I think that we need to see real backbone from the Democrats to either slow down or completely defeat this nomination, this confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett. And it remains to be seen whether they're up to the task.
That was Marjorie Cohn, Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and author. For more analysis and commentary on Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thank you. On Inauguration Day 2017, Women's March organizers in just a few months pulled off what's considered to be the largest single-day protest event in U.S. history, with almost 500,000 people jamming the pre-COVID streets of Washington, D.C., with a total of up to 5 million protesters gathered in cities and towns across the U.S. that day to make loud and visible their passionate opposition to Donald Trump's hateful agenda as he took office. The idea for the Women's March was born on Facebook the day after the 2016 election, when a woman living in Hawaii named Teresa Shook voiced her opinion that a pro-woman march was needed as a reaction to Trump's victory. Soon, veteran activists and organizers began planning a large-scale event scheduled for January 21, 2017, the day after Inauguration Day. In the intervening 3.5 years, leadership of the organization has changed, but the movement has remained active and is now planning marches all across the U.S. on October 17th, calling for Trump's defeat in the 2020 election and opposition to his attempt to fill Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat on the Supreme Court. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Tabitha St. Bernard Jacobs, Deputy Executive Director of Program at Women's March. Here she talks about the mission of the group, recent actions, and why they're marching again on October 17th.
Women's March has been marching every year since then. We've had a march every January since then. We've also had incredible programming. Just this year alone, we have a text banking program where Women's March volunteers have sent and received over 3 million texts to women voters in key states to make sure that they just have everything they need to vote. In just 2 days last week, our volunteer texters sent over 700,000 texts to voters in key presidential swing states and states that are really going to be the ones that will decide control of the Senate. Since we announced the march last week, we've had more than 99,000 people pledge to vote. And we have, I think we're up to 202 marches all across the country in 46 states. And that's just literally in the last couple of months. The work has really continued on for the last couple of years. And it's really brought us to this moment where we are right now, when women are leaning into our power even more and realizing that this election is going to come down to us. Women are going to really be the ones who are going to decide this election.
Can men march?
Men can march. People of different gender identities can march. This is a movement that's open to people who are aligned with freedom for women. So as long as you identify as a feminist, or even if you don't and you just believe in the power of women, there's space for you in this movement.
Is there any significance to the date of the marches being October 17th?
We thought of a date that would be far enough into the future for people to be able to organize around, but also at a date where it's really pivotal, where some states will be having early voting, some states people can still go in to register to vote. So different people across the country can activate however suits them best in their own locations. And we have 212 marches across the country. So we have small marches. We have some people who are just gathering together in small groups. And we're saying, listen, we're a week and a half away from the march. Whatever suits you best is completely fine. We just want people to get out into the streets. And even if people don't feel safe to get out into the streets, we have virtual actions happening as well. We're going to be having text banking that will also be happening on the same day. So there are different ways that people can take part in it, whatever way suits them best, whatever way they're most comfortable with. But the main point is for everybody to just realize that this moment comes down to us, and we have the power to make the type of change we all need in this country. And we need everybody showing up in whatever way is best suited for them in this moment.
Tabitha St. Bernard Jacobs, the current occupant of the White House, likes to talk about, quote, suburban housewives, unquote, who are afraid of Black people and should come out to vote for him. What's your pitch to women who aren't activists and maybe even voted for Trump in 2016?
Well, I think the idea that the identity of a suburban housewife, if even that's even the way he wants to phrase it, that there's one identity, is kind of ridiculous. I think that the suburbs are getting more diverse. Women are much more diverse than we've ever been. And beating Donald Trump is really going to come down to the power of women. I'm a mom. I have two small kids. My son is 5, my daughter's 1, and I'm speaking to the people around me. I'm speaking to my neighbors. I'm speaking to my friends. It's really going to come down to people power. It's really going to come down to the power of women really organizing within our local communities. We have Sisterhood Sundays that we kicked off a couple of weeks ago, which is a program where we're calling every woman who is a part of our base, and we're encouraging them to identify 3 other women in their lives that they're going to be accountable with, and they're going to be supporting them and helping them come up with a voting plan. And then we're sort of providing support for them so that as we come closer to the actual election, we're going to be checking in with them and saying, like, do you have a plan to vote? How can we support you in this? And that's what it's going to come down to. It's going to come down to people supporting each other and having a voting plan and getting to the polls and to just realize our power in this election. And it's really going to come down to women.
So the main focus of all these events on October 17th is to emphasize the need to get out to vote. Is that right?
So another key goal of the march is for the power of women to really send a message that we are the most powerful electoral force, and we want to show that in a very strong way, that we will be the ones deciding the next Supreme Court justice. And we are strong in the belief that there should not be a confirmation of a Supreme Court justice before the inauguration.
I know a lot of groups are strategizing about what to do after the election if Trump won't support a peaceful transition of power should he lose. Is Women's March engaged in any of those discussions or planning?
We have been involved in efforts around protecting the election and also in terms of what happens after the actual election, helping people know that it's not going to all come down to what happens on the actual election night, but it's actually going to be what happens afterwards. So we've been involved in those efforts. We've been preparing our base to be prepared to safeguard themselves and to be prepared for what happens afterwards.
That was Tabitha St. Bernard Jacobs, Deputy Executive Director of Program with Women's March. For more information on the organizing being done for the October 17th Nationwide Women's March, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WPPM in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.